Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie, and I'm delighted to be talking to the most famous classicist in the world, Mary Beard, who has written about everything from the Roman emperors to Pompeii, the Colosseum and the Parthenon, and now she's written a terrific book called Talking Classics, The Shock of the Old. And it covers an awful amount of things, Mary, but it's at heart, would you say, it's about why you should do classics and the wonder of classics.
It's about the wonder of classics. It's about, I think, I try to avoid should. I try to avoid an obligation, you know. I say at one point, it's, you know, there's no it's not compulsory to be interested in the ancient world, but, you know, it's a pity not to be because it's very interesting. Yeah. And it's trying to take, or partly it's taking a fresh look and saying, you know, should we sit there and feel that this is the wellspring of Western civilization and we should admire it, as some people say, or should we say, as a whole lot of other people say, oh, this is classics, Greeks and Romans, they've legitimated such, you know, such appalling regimes. Let's look at fascism, you know. Where did fascism find its branding? Well, in the Greeks and Romans, or particularly the Romans. And I'm trying to say, look, both of those just kind of get it a bit wrong. So that's, in a sense, my pitch is, so, okay, how have they got it a bit wrong? And as you say, use the word kind of amazement and wonder. I do think that looking at people who lived almost 3,000 years ago is, in some cases, is wondrous. I mean, it is the fact that we can do it, you know. The fact that 2,000 years ago we've still got the jottings, bedside jottings of a Roman emperor. Now, you might not like them, I don't very much, but how amazing is that? So that's one bit. The other bit is, I suppose it's a kind of, I wouldn't see it as justification, but I've studied and taught the ancient world for 50 years now. I've taught about people long dead, some of them horrible, some of them interesting, some of them no doubt quite nice. How when I get to St. Peter, how will I justify what I've done? You know, how will I say that career, I think that career was worthwhile, and I do think that. Why do I think it?
And you begin with this really moving scene of your mother taking you to the British Museum, I think when you were five in 1960, and a moment of Thauma happens. Can you explain what Thauma is and what the moment was?
Thauma is a key word in the book, and it is about wonderment and amazement, partly in our sense, the Greek term, as in thaumatic, you might say, wondrous. It's about eye-opening moments where you think, blimey, you know, oh, that's amazing, literally, you know, the kind of why factor moments. But it's also, I'm taking up the great philosophical understanding of wonderment, which is that wonderment doesn't stop with just you saying, wow. It makes you think harder about things. So both Plato and Aristotle did say, look, philosophy starts in thauma, in being amazed, in wonderment. So that's the background too.
Yeah.
I was five, I knew nothing, I never heard of Plato and Aristotle. Mm. You know, it goes without saying. We lived in Shropshire, deep country, and my mum was a village schoolmistress, and I'd never been to London when I was five, and we're back now in 1960. She thought it was time that I saw a big city, the big city, London, so we went from the train. And we were going to go to the British Museum. We had sort of much more, less cerebral things to do, but we were going to go to the British Museum. And I wanted to see, like every five-year-old, I wanted to see the Egyptian mummies, didn't I? You know, which we did. Indeed, see, my mum was in some ways quite a typical school teacher, and she said, "Fine, that's great, but if you're going to see the dead Egyptians," she said, slightly finger waggingly, "you ought to see what they did when they were alive too." So we went to the Egyptian sort of everyday life room. And I still remember this. And I think anybody who knows what museums were like in 1960 will remember that they weren't child-friendly. The cases were high, you couldn't see into them. They weren't aimed at kids. And my mum was looking around and she said, "Oh my goodness me, there's a piece of almost 4,000-year-old Egyptian bread in that case." I thought, I'll see that, you know. The mummies had been amazing, but here was a piece of something that really spoke to me, which is a bit of bread. She tried to lift me up, but it was quite hard. And at that moment, a guy walks by who I remember thinking must have been very old, but I probably was about 38 or something. And he said, "Was I wanting to see anything in particular?" And I said, "Yes, I want to see that piece of bread." He got keys in his pockets, must have been a curator, opened the case, leant inside, got the bread out and held it in front of my little nose. And that was a sort of heart-stopping moment. You know, it was being so, so close. You know, with no mediation between me, no glass between me and the bread. I was so close to it, and it was so ordinary, so kind of just what I might eat, just what any Egyptian might eat, and yet so distant, so amazing. This is, I couldn't even conceive then what 4,000 years old would be.
And you very movingly dedicate your book to him. And is it too much of a stretch to say that it's what you've done in your books and programs is opening up the ancient world, and you talk very persuasively about classics shouldn't be something you treat with reverence and gratitude. You could be struck by Thelma or even hatred or horror, but not have that reverence for the old grand language.
It's not kind of... get back here and stand at a distance because this is classics, you know, and admire it, but don't get too close. You know, I think it would be obviously completely wrong to say that at the time I thought, oh, there's a lesson here about opening museum cases. But as I thought about that story as I got older, I saw that he was not just helping a little girl who wanted to see something. He was giving her a model of how to treat the ancient world and about a more general metaphorical model of opening cases for people and letting them get close and encouraging and welcoming them in rather than keeping them out at a reverential distance or at a distance where people say, "Oh, I don't like this much, a bit boring," or very conservative. It was saying, get up close.
And also see what you're very good at in your books and programmes, saying there, the Romans and the Greeks are really just like us. And there's a brilliant bit in your book about the four paintings in the Bar of Salvius in Pompeii. Can you explain what those fantastic pictures are of and what they're saying then?
Pompeii is a wonderful place for kind of catching the Romans off their guard, you know, when they're not expecting you to be looking at them or for them. This is not the kind of great literature of Horace saying I'm writing for everybody forever. This is people going about their everyday business. And there's a great bar. It's not a particularly impressive one, but it's in central Pompeii. It's called the Bar of Salvius because there's a bit of painting. And there's an election slogan on the outside of the bar which says, "Salvius says vote for so-and-so." So maybe Salvius owned this bar, maybe not. And inside, there's a little painted strip cartoon which gives you four scenes of life in the bar. And it's really like a strip cartoon because they've got speech bubbles coming. The characters in the strip cartoon have got speech bubbles coming out of their head. And you feel very close to them. There's a man and woman having a snog. And he's saying, "Oh, something like the Latin is a bit odd here. Oh, you know, I'd rather be doing this with you than with whoever, right?"
Yeah. Myrtle.
That's right. You know, yeah. So there's a bit of the prelude to sex going on. There's then two scenes of there's a couple of guys at a gaming board, and in the first scene there's the waitress. She's coming by in the bar. They're obviously in the sit-down area of the bar, the saloon bar, I suppose we'd say. And she's saying something like, look, whose drink is this? You know, if you don't want it, I'll give it to somebody else. Then you see them having a row about their gaming. The characters repeat in the next scene. And somebody says, oh, I got two, I've won. You know, no, you didn't, right? So a row is starting. In the final scene, the row is getting worse. They're still going on, calling each other pretty awful names. And although it's pretty battered, you can still see the speech bubbles. And a guy who's obviously the landlord is saying, look, guys, if you want to fight, get outside. Like, you think, you know, how many landlords have not said that in the last...
Yeah, it's the dog and duck down the high street, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, it is. And there is something very, very it's arresting because you recognise it, because you see, you know, you can see scenes that you think that you know, you know, the cross landlord, the slightly cross waitress and all the rest. And that for me it's wonderful. It's a, you know, wonderful little glimpse into ancient life. I think and this is where Thalma comes in, though, a bit. I think it's also, when you think about it, it is both, oh, my goodness me, this is just like us, right? You know, I know these things. I can recognise this. You know, I've been there. I've been in that kind of... and that's partly true. But at the same time, and this is what I think gives classics, or gives a lot of history, actually, its edge, there is this sense that, and yet it's very, very distant. I'm not sure I do understand. Yeah. It feels like it's like me, but we're living in a world here, if we're a Pompeian, that is so different from my own, that me sitting here 2,000 years later saying, gosh, that's just like us, is both right and wrong. No, it isn't. They're both familiar and alien creatures. And I think that's what in some ways keeps the ancient world, it's what kind of drives people's curiosity about the ancient world. Because if they were simply and only just like us, you know, we don't need to study them if they're just like us. If they were completely alien, you know, if it was like kind of meeting a load of dinosaurs, I wouldn't, you know, some people I know are very keen on dinosaurs, but I wouldn't want to spend my life, you know, working on the social life of dinosaurs. It's so alien, it isn't about me. Yeah. And it's that kind of, it's that combination of familiarity and distance.
And you talk in a nice phrase about the paradoxical newness of classics, and you've got a great quote from A. Stallings, the Oxford professor of poetry, who says, "The ancients taught me how to sound modern," yeah. And you can illuminate the modern through the ancient.
Yeah, you can. And, I mean, what I think we tend to forget, and what I suppose accounts for the subtitle of the book, The Shock of the Old, is that we have so turned it into rather unremarkable, traditional art forms, literary forms. We might be interested in them. I'm not saying they're not interesting in our imagination, but we sort of take them for granted. You know, you walk down through a big museum of classical antiquities, and you go past all these female nudes, and you think, Venus, another Venus, you know. You don't stop, and you certainly don't stop and think, when that sculpture was made, and I'm thinking here of one particularly famous, the Aphrodite from the town of Knidos in modern Turkey, supposed to be the first female nude full-size ever made in the Greek world. And it was so shocking. It was, people thought, in one town said, I don't want that in my town, thank you very much. Very foolish error, because it became a big tourist attraction. It went to the town of Knidos. There is something here that they would the ancients were doing things that no one had done before, and which didn't feel tired or a bit samey or a bit stereotyped. They, you know, when you walk past these statues, you just say, blimey, gosh, that's amazing. And I think that would, you know, some things like the Parthenon sculptures, which we now do kind of, you know, we bow our heads and we're very reverential about them, and I can understand why. But nobody had seen sculpture quite like that when that was done. So how did that happen? And can we recapture that sense of again, amazement, thauma? A bit, you know, not in time.
And you talk about how it informs views of the modern world. You're extremely good on Nelson Mandela reading Antigone, Sophocles' Antigone, in Robben Island Jail. Can you talk a bit about that? And actually, Bob Dylan thanked Odysseus in his 2016 yes. Nobel Prize speech. So yes. You talk about the threads going through the modern greats,
yeah.
as it were.
Yeah, and sometimes in unexpected places, because, you know, we can all sit down and think that Alexander Pope would be very keen on all this. But if you say Nelson Mandela, you know, do you know he was really interested in Sophocles' play Antigone? You think, that would be surprising, I think. And Antigone, you know, the play about the young girl who defies the state, defies the orders of the state, in order to give proper burial to her brother, who'd been part of the civil war, and then is punished basically by death. She commits suicide before the punishment can be carried out, but she's sentenced to death. That has been a play that has resonated with freedom fighters, young girls as well, ever since. And I think people are often familiar with the World War II versions that of Antigone, with Brecht doing his Antigone, where Antigone's adversary, Creon, the ruler of the city of Thebes, where she's living, is, you know, is a barely disguised Hitler. But I think people are not so familiar with the idea that the prisoners who were bound up in Robben Island under apartheid, they performed the Antigone too. And in his autobiography, Mandela's got quite a lot to say about it, but including one thing which I've always thought, until I'd been writing this book, I didn't know, that in this performance, Mandela played not the freedom fighter, he played the tyrant who was sentencing tyrant sentencing Antigone to death. And, you know, and he says, interestingly, and he has a sharper reading of that play than many people have had, because he says, look, Creon doesn't start out in this play as being awful. He becomes awful. He becomes the man who sentences Antigone to death and basically loses his wife and son also in the fallout of that. He started out trying to get the city together after the Civil War. And it all goes terribly wrong. So, you know, thinking of Mandela as the tyrant Creon is
fascinating. And at the same time, you knock over quite a few sacred cows, including the famous one that the Greeks invented democracy. You say this is a dreadful case of tunnel vision.
It is. It's, yeah. I mean, I'm afraid. I've got nothing against democracy here. What I've got against is the idea that that the Greeks, or particularly the Athenians, invented it. And that's partly because democracy isn't the kind of thing that you invent. You know, it's not like invented the steam engine. You know, democracy is a way of thinking about the world. And as many anthropologists have pointed out, there have been all kinds of communities across the world who have tried something similar from as far back as we can see. But I think what it does is it is tunnel vision, but it also, I think, ill-equips us to think about our own democracy. So, you know, we say, all right, the Greeks invented democracy, and then what happens in our imagination is everything's fine then. You know, they dress up in sheets, they're very calm, they debate things very kind of responsibly, and it is a wholly good bit of governmental organisation, right? you know, they got it right. Now, actually, the one thing that you learn about a thing in democracy is that it was quite short-lived, you know, 150 years or so. It was also absolutely viciously contested the whole time. You know, there were coups, there were assassinations. Most of the Greek writers that we have thought it was a very bad idea, democracy. You know?
And a very limited demos.
And anyway, it was a very it was a very limited demos. And I suppose I can almost, not quite, I can almost forgive the Athenians for not thinking of including the women. Although that's quite a hard ask for me, all the slaves. But I think if we think of it as an attempt at shared rule, it's an attempt at what, you know, they invented the word democracy, that's fine, they just didn't invent the thing. It's what it should be reminding us of, not, oh, how wonderful democracy it is, should be reminding us, look, democracy is a hard act. You know, democracy is always a work in progress. It's always being countered. You know, if you want democracy, you don't sit back and think of the Greeks and bask in their glory. You think you have to work hard at it. And I think if there's, you know, there's one lesson that perhaps, you know, modern, you know, we who are all part of the modern state, if there's one lesson we should take away from Athens, it's not that democracy is admirable. It is that if you want it, you have to work at it. It doesn't, you know, you can never, ever take democracy for granted. That's the lesson of the Athenians.
And another sacred cow you topple is the idea that a lot of the buildings we go to see as tourists aren't actually Roman. And you've got a brilliant bit on the Temple of Vesta in Rome, where their Vestal versions tended the city's sacred flame, inundated by tourists. But what's actually going on there?
Mostly what the tourists are snapping, and I'm not being remotely holier than thou here, because in my time I've snapped this temple. Basically, it's a recon by Mussolini's archaeologists. And you know, one thing I think a lot of people know is that you know, Mussolini invested heavily in the antique Roman background of the modern city of Rome. And he saw himself and presented himself a bit kind of in the guise of Julius Caesar or the Emperor Augustus. He did a huge amount of archaeology, sponsored loads of archaeology in the city. And he proceeded, and I think that anybody probably would have. They reconstructed bits, they put it back together again. And you always have to do that with ancient ruins, otherwise they just fall down again. You know, you need to have modern intervention. But some of these sites, like the Temple of Vesta in the Forum, that we go and see, we're looking at Mussolini's image of Rome as much as we're looking at the image of ancient Rome itself. And there's a very famous monument, the Altar of Peace, Augustus's Ara Pacis. A bit of it had been found in earlier centuries. You know, Mussolini excavates a fantastic sculpture from it and then puts it back together someplace else, right? Well, we assume when we go and visit it now, this is where it's always been. Right. No, it wasn't. It was put up there in a nice little fascist pavilion by Mussolini. And I think that I don't want people to be put off by that, because we're always, you know, everybody's always reinventing the ancient world. You know, Pompeii is partly in some of its bigger buildings. You know, they too have had work done on them. You know, modern work done on them. I mean, it has to be. It's not a cause for guilt. But I think
but useful to know that
we should not be naive to think that the ancient world just survives miraculously. I mean, I've been in so many buildings in Pompeii and I've been sort of sitting down, resting my knees, and people come in and they say, oh, I didn't know the roof survived. And you want to say, it didn't.
You stay quiet at those moments,
yeah.
Too?
Yeah. Normally. No, I can't say it always, but normally. But sometimes, you know, and you can get a good conversation if you go in, if you've got the time.
And you've always been brilliant on women in the ancient world, but this book is full of juicy nuggets about how women have been patronised in more recent studying of classics. And you talk about this brilliant expression I'd never come across called ladies Greek. And you say you're only capable of ladies Greek. I know that isn't true.
Well, it's not quite.
Can you explain where it came from?
Slightly overmodest. Yeah. It's from Elizabeth Barrett Browning's kind of verse novel, Aurora Leigh. And at one point, I can't remember which point in the story, it's not a hugely gripping story, a guy sees some Greek, some ancient Greek written out, and he recognises it to be written out by a woman, ladies Greek, because it doesn't have the whole complicated system of accents and diacriticals put on it that modern Greek texts now have. Right? Now, and in the kind of in women's fight to be included in the classical world, in particularly in the 19th century, they did home in on Greek and they did get taught it. Virginia Woolf's essay on not knowing Greek is quite a
brilliant
joke. Really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, essay. She certainly knew it very well.
But they were never taught what the little boys were taught, which is how to put the accents and other signs on that you'd now find in a modern printed text. And so, as the kind of male classical establishment saw women coming up from behind to join in on the fun of ancient Greek, they kind of put the barriers a bit higher and said, oh, if you want to really know it properly, you've got to put accents on it. And so the phrase ladies Greek once had great currency. There is a sting in the tale, and a joke about this is that most of these accents were invented by early medieval Byzantine monks. And, you know, Sophocles and Plato would not have put accents on their Greek. So there's something kind of very sort of bizarre in that women are chided for not writing Greek using the signs on the Greek that the ancient Greeks themselves would never have used.
Right. Yes, right. How funny. Yeah, 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 yeah. And you have an absolutely stunning revelation to me, brought up on Kennedy's Latin primer, like many listeners, that it wasn't actually written by Kennedy.
No, it wasn't. It was
unbelievable. Now, that's Thalma. Yeah.
That is... Kennedy wrote a very, very unsuccessful Latin grammar book, Latin primer, which was called The Public School Latin Primer. And it was useless. It was complicated. Nobody could see their way through it, etc., etc. He was an interesting man, Kennedy. And he was interesting. I mean, he had been a teacher and then became a professor of Greek in Cambridge. But he had a mission to write a usable Latin grammar for the kids. But after the failure of the public school Latin primer, the people who took over the project were his daughters, Marion and Julia, who actually, we don't know what behind the scenes in the Kennedy household was like, but they must have said, look, Dad, this is hopeless. Give it, you know, let us do it. And there is no doubt that this is what's happening, because Christopher Stray, a guy who's worked a huge amount on the history of Latin teaching in this country, has looked through the Macmillan's archives, and there are all the letters from Marion and Julia. They're clearly writing it. The only thing that makes me kind of really sad about the story is that they don't even get a mention in the thanks.
You know? And probably didn't get any of the royalties.
No, no. And it is still on sale. I still use Kennedy's Latin primer when I'm, you know, wanting to look up a bit of Latin grammar that I've forgotten. Now, I have an extra thrill, though, because I think written by Marion and Julia.
How funny. His version, his earlier version, is what, badly written and garbled? Or...
And it's very German. Sorry, it's going to sound very bad and very kind of ethnocentric, but I say it's very Germanic. It's taken from German primers, and it's over-technical. I mean, it's very hard to... much harder than you think when you're kind of used to taking... a Latin grammar book for granted. Actually working out how you lay it out and, you know, what you put first. And you know, different countries actually do different things here, and they, you know, they choose to focus and to order things very differently. And this one worked, you know, and they were good, sensible women, and he had taught them Latin at home. And they cornered the market.
That's fascinating. And talking about things being hard, you got a brilliant quote from a colleague when you were discussing that idea of why you should do classics. And she said, classics teaches you to read difficult things. Yeah. What was the context of that?
It was back when I was a quite young lecturer in Cambridge, and it was the time of it was the time when universities were getting very, very focused on transferable skills. What does, you know, you learn Latin and Greek, or you learn about the ancient world, but what are the transferable skills that you learn when you're doing that? Now, that was just at its, that was just the beginning when I was, when this incident happened. And, you know, the idea was, what do you say now? We're very used to answering those questions. What does classics teach you? Well, you know, it teaches you to work under pressure because they do exams, or it teaches you timekeeping skills because you have to get your essay in on time, that kind of stuff. And it's now become pretty sort of routinized in discourse. You probably can go into a student handbook and it will say, what are the transferable skills that this teaches you? But it was new back then.
Right.
And we had a meeting, and the administrator said, just ask a simple question. What does classics teach you? And I thought, how? You know, I was in my early 30s. How would I answer that? You know, I wasn't quite sure what you were supposed to say. And the person in question was Pat Easterling, who went on to become the first female Regius Professor of Greek. And she was clearly going to answer straight away. And I thought, you know, what's she going to say? Is she going to talk about the wellsprings of civilization? You know, and she just said it teaches you to read difficult things. And, you know, it's not the only thing that teaches you to read difficult things, but classics does teach you to read difficult things very effectively. And, you know, if you think about, you know, the moment we are at now, you know, people are, you know, frequently now sort of worrying about the future of reading. And, you know, I think in some ways rightly, in some ways wrongly. But I think she hit the nail more on the head, really, because, you know, it's not, what we need is not just people to pick up a novel at night, though I'm very pleased. You know, speaking as chair of the Booker Prize, I'm very pleased if they do. We need people to be able to read things that are hard, and to get stuff out of what's difficult, and to see the complexity and the complication and the subtlety of difficult writing. And a lot of the kind of things that we need to read, a lot of the background to modern politics, to world culture, to making decisions about things, economics, they're difficult. And what I want a university education to do, and I think classics is very good at it, is help people read difficult things, teach them to read difficult things. That, you know, reading is not just for pleasure. Reading is for struggling with and getting the complicated points out.
And that leads me on to, I am, like you, very pro reading classics and translation. In fact, in your lovely library in Cambridge, in front of me, you have Emily Wilson's brilliant translation of Homer's Odyssey. But I'm sure you've just read that only 206 people did A-level Greek last year in the country. Does that concern you?
Yeah, of course it does. I feel concerned, but also quite optimistic. I mean, I think Latin is having, partly thanks to the charity Classics for All, who is helping getting Latin back in the state school curriculum. You know, there's a buzz and there's a feel for Latin. That isn't the same with Greek. I think it's a pity, but Greek has always been a very minority option, you know, that and it is actually quite, it's not that difficult to learn Greek once you've learned Latin. And the lingua franca has always been Latin. And if I'm going to be standing on, you know, on the bridge, you know, defending the classical tradition, what I need to defend is the teaching, the widespread availability, not compulsory, availability of the teaching of Latin. Now, after that, of course, I want people to learn Greek too, but it's much easier to pick that up. And you know, most of the women who came to Cambridge in the 19th century, they weren't actually like Virginia Woolf. They probably had learnt no Greek at all, but they had learnt Latin either at school or home. And they always were in the position of picking up Greek, sometimes very, very effectively. And in fact, in Cambridge, since I was an undergraduate here in the 70s, there has been, that's over 50 years, there has always been what we now call a pathway in the classics course where you learn Greek from scratch.
And could people, however brilliant they are, you've taught exactly these people, have they been able to catch up with those who've had the advantage of knowing it for years? Because it's not like the ones who already know it just stand still. They're also doing other stuff at the same time.
You know, I think my answer to that is yes. And you know, some of the people who are now professors of Greek in this country learn Greek that way. I'm not saying that it's, you know, I think they would have said that their undergraduate course was tougher, having to learn Greek too. But they have done it very successfully. And I've retired now, but my colleagues here had come up through that pathway. I think that classicists can be a bit too gloomy about how it's all going to the dogs. Now, that doesn't mean you've got to be forever watchful, and you've got to make sure that there are the possibilities of people being able to substitute for not having done it at school. You know, it's not always brilliant to have done it at school. We all know. I don't know. I dread to think, Harry, about what your experience of Latin
Greek. I can tell you once the recorder's off. Yeah.
But you know, I know people. I'm married to one who did not much else other than Latin and Greek from the age of their early teens. Now, whether that was good educational practice, I rather doubt.
And we'll finish on a great triumph of yours, Mary. I'd say about 10 years ago, you were in a debate with a classicist called Boris Johnson. He was defending Greece, you were defending Rome. You soundly defeated him. And would you say Roman civilization was superior to the Greek civilization?
No. I'm more interested in it. And I think we need to go back a step because Boris... I was very, very keen. I confess, I did want to beat him. But we were both playing the good party game to raise money for Classics for All, actually. And so he was taking the side of the Greeks. It's a stupid argument. Are the Greeks better than the Romans?
No, a very enjoyable evening. Still,
evening because you kind of, you put your doubts about the question away and you get down to it and you get hands out and you have a bit of a fight. And it was good fun. I mean, I've recently, the last 30 years, worked more on the Romans than on Greek culture. Not entirely. I've always talked Greek and Roman and I've written about ancient Greece. I think, for me, the complexity, the metropolitan size of Rome. You know, Rome is a city of 1 million people by the reign of Augustus, first emperor. And that's no city in Europe came up to that size until 19th century London. And you know, it's the difficulty and the subtlety, the sheer kind of urban in-your-faceness of it that makes it...
Along with the vast size of the empire as well.
Even before you get to the empire, yeah. And also, but it's fascinating because it knows, you know, it recognises. It's a kind of post. It's a post culture because it sees itself in a wondering, in quite a complicated way, about how they relate to earlier Greek traditions. And they're also, I mean, you mentioned empire. They're not. Not every Roman is a jingoistic bastard saying, you know, thrash the bastards. Now, I'm sure there were plenty of Romans who were jingoistic bastards. But Rome itself, like, I think a lot of imperial powers, they nurture within them people who question the empire as much as people who support it. And there is a strong divergent trend in Roman literature looking at the empire and wondering about its morality, its effect on Rome itself. What's, you know, what happens to you if you have an empire? You know, and from as far back as Sallust in 1st century BC, there are people saying Rome started to go down the tubes when it got an empire. Go to the end of the first, end of, beginning of the 2nd century CE, there's Tacitus, you know, Tacitus, a man who did very well out of Roman politics despite his dissident reputation, great historian. He puts into the mouth of one of his characters thinking about what Rome's contribution has been to the world. And it is the famous phrase, they make a desert and call it peace. And I don't think anyone has summed up imperial conquest better than saying they make a desert and call it peace. And that's somehow what you get with Rome, the complexity, the size, the questioning that comes with living in this kind of complicated world, half-world power. It throws up some of the big questions, which are still our questions. I mean, I think we can all name deserts that have been created in our lifetime in the name of peace.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good place to stop. And thank you so much to Mary Beard for talking about her wonderful new book, Talking Classics, The Shock of the Old.
Thank you so much, Harry. Thank you.
You have been listening to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldi magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.